host, Dr. Joyce Starr, and Rights Radio is brought to you by StarPublications.com and Dr. Joyce Starr Publishing. I established this niche publishing house in 2006, specializing in condo owners and homeowner association rights, natural wellness and vitality solutions, age less and live younger, and natural pet care solutions. Our motto, books that empower, heal, and inspire. Our guest today is speaking about a topic that is foremost in all of our minds, the coming economic revival, how and when. Our guest is Dr. David Goldenberg. Dr. Goldenberg authored Creating Condo and Homeowner Association Documents, one of the three books in our Homeowners Association Rights Defense Kit, as well as our special report on how to recall your condo board in 10 steps. He's also co-chairman of our Rights Radio think tank, Brain Trust. Among many other books that he's authored, he wrote The Art of War 3, The Canons of Commerce, an insight-filled interpretation of Sun Tzu's Art of War from a business perspective. And one reviewer said, "The Art of War goes straight for the jugular and leaves very little room for a wandering mind." Well, I can tell you from knowing him as long as I have that Dr. Goldenberg's mind does not wander. He's got keen insight, and he's going to share it with us today on economic strategies for revival. Welcome, Dave.
Why, thank you, Joyce. How are you?
I'm great, and we're so happy to have you with us today, talking about something that's so near and dear to all of us. I understand that you have a plan that you're about to present to a group of economists, primarily practitioners, some academics and some students. Is that right?
That's correct.
And what prompted you to create this particular plan, economic revival strategy?
I didn't want to live in poverty. I didn't want my kids to, or anyone else, if it was avoidable. And I felt that there was a way out, but it wasn't well known. So the thing to do was to make it better known and hope somebody would be gullible enough to act on it.
Oh, I don't think they'd be gullible if they listened to you, but it takes a lot of time and energy to create such a plan. I know you've put in long and hard hours, and it's primarily at this moment a PowerPoint. And since obviously our listeners can't see a PowerPoint, you're kind enough to share the main issues that your plan is based on. But let me start by asking you, do you think we're going to see recovery as soon as the next quarter? That's what we're hearing from several television pundits.
Yes, I've heard some of that, too. I think it's utter nonsense or a prayer and desperation. There are two reasons why I don't think we can see a recovery starting, although it actually can start sooner, but you won't see the effects until about 2012, about 4 years from now. The first reason is that one of the things we have to clear away is the housing problem. We have more than a two-year supply of houses to sell at current sales rates. And actually, since things are going to get worse for a while, it'll take longer than 2 years. But that's the earliest you can see that obstacle being cleared away. The second thing is a bit subtler and depends on trust in an expert. There's a Nobel Prize laureate named Harry Markowitz out on the West Coast now, and he's an authority on risk and risk measurement. And Harry circulated a paper indicating that, in his opinion, which you have to trust because he's the foremost authority on the subject, it'll take at least 3 years to evaluate the risks associated with the various financial instruments that are outstanding. But what he did not mention, because it seemed obvious to him, is that it would take a year to assemble a team to do that work. And once the team's at work, it'll take them 3 years to deliver the initial report, and they would have to go on from there. In effect, he's saying that the various financial instrument rating agencies have to be replaced with competent people.
But who's going to replace them? The president is going to come in and instantly replace all of these folks?
There are, if you dig into most of these agencies, they're using youngsters and MBAs with little or no experience and arbitrary rules and not accurate measurements. So you're in effect, you're replacing people with certificates in first aid with practicing physicians. And there are more than enough experts around, but you've got to round them up and you've got to pay them a living wage.
What would make them want to go to Washington to do it at any rate? Why would
they? They don't
want
have to go to Washington. These days they can work from home. But the point is, you've got to get these instruments identified by name and know how much is involved with each and what the characteristics are of each so that you can assess the risks in isolation for instrument one, and then how this interacts with the rest of the financial instruments outstanding. So you need both a measure of direct risk and indirect risk. And until you have those risks assessed, you really can't trust the markets to rate them or quote, value them or put a price on them. So we've got a period of at least 4 years before the financial markets can come back to working order because they don't have the information they need to process.
Do you feel that the powers that be understand that they need these type of people in place? And the reason I mention Washington is because this is very, you know, important material, and typically the people who work on it aren't sitting in their homes working by telephone. They're usually sitting in a terribly dull office in Washington and meeting by the drinking fountain. That's a bit of the problem, because for security clearances alone, they have to be sitting in Washington.
Well, let me put it this way. I doubt very much that the typical politician or political leader or as a group have the knowledge to deal with the problem. And
what about
I doubt
the people applying for the jobs
quickly?
Pardon?
What they will have to do is assemble a team of experts and trust the experts and act on the advice, very much like when you feel ill, you go to a physician and you ask for a treatment regimen and you take their word for it and you act on it because you just don't have the time to go learn to be a doctor first in order to treat your temporary condition.
But do you feel that this is going to happen? That this fundamental step that you've just outlined is going to happen? Do you feel confident that it will or not at all?
Well, I ran three scenarios.
Okay.
And one of them gets us out of the mess within a reasonable span of time by 2025.
Whoa.
The other two do not. One, in effect, is a replay of the Great Depression. And the second one is about half that intense, which is typical of the kind of phenomena we've seen over the years with recent business cycles since the Great Depression. And the third one is the only way out that I've been able to discover, and I call that von Neumann's turnpike.
Can you explain who von Neumann is?
Yeah, John von Neumann was a sort of wizard in mathematics. He was a lightning calculator. He was a mathematical prodigy. He was a professor at the Institute for Advanced Study where Einstein worked and so on.
In Austria?
No, he overlapped Einstein to some degree, but he was a bit younger.
Mm-hmm.
And so during World War II, he was a consultant to the Manhattan Project because he was assigned to something of greater priority. And it's never been disclosed just what that project is. But he was kept rather busy. So for recreation, he got together with a colleague and wrote a very comprehensive book called The Theory of Games and Economic Behavior. And that was done for relaxation, and it's driven most economists batty into learning advanced math. But von Neumann also worked on the question of how fast can you grow an economy. And he based that on his experiences commuting back and forth between the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton and work at Columbia University. And one day he observed that if I want to go home quickly, I take a different route than if I want to take the shortest route. If I want to go home by the shortest route, I get in my car at 116th Street and Broadway in New York and drive through downtown Manhattan to the Holland Tunnel, get on Route 1, and drive to Princeton. And in about an hour and a half, I'm there. But if I want to go home quickly, I get in my car and drive north, away from Princeton, to the George Washington Bridge, cross the bridge, get on the New Jersey Turnpike, drive like a bat out of hell to the Princeton exit, and then take the back roads home. I'm home in about an hour. He put this in a mathematical expression, but it came down to that if you want to grow the economy quickly, first you have to put it in condition to grow quickly. Restructuring is the proper term. Then you grow it as fast as you can till it gets to the right size, and then restructure it again to have the right mix of goods and services. And essentially, that's what I'm proposing now.
And
the only way out of or recouping the huge losses we've incurred is to grow not just our economy, but essentially every major economy, because we're interdependent, as fast as we can until we're out of this problem.
But how does this differ from the traditional approach to economic strategy?
There are several different approaches that have been tried.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of them are political in nature and ignore economic guidance and have a very common characteristic in that they've been found not to work. So we have to look at something that is more likely to succeed. But among the possibilities are debasing our currency. This is inflation. Just defaulting, which is popular in Latin America. Sorry, not going to pay you. I'm broke. Trying for isolation and just saying, okay, I'm going to live like Robinson Crusoe on my own little island and the rest of the world can go to hell. One that has not been tried particularly is to sell assets. As you know, the government of the United States owns an enormous amount of land and buildings and so on. It could sell some of that. It also has, of course, the power to seize personal property. But it can only do this sort of thing once. A more popular or more commonly used approach is war. And right now we have some very tough questions if we try that approach. The main one is, can we win a thermonuclear war? Because never before have we been in a position to cause such incredible destruction. So I don't think any of the traditional options are very good. And I think history pretty much shows that. So instead, what we need is something that works in coordination with all the other leading economies of the world, and we need a coordinated plan. This is, yes, it is a form of government intervention, but it has to be very carefully guided and controlled because the needs of the different economies are such. You just can't use the same techniques for each economy.
But let me ask you about selling assets. You mentioned that, and that one doesn't hear about that. In fact, rarely do you hear anyone recommending that the government sell its assets, which are quite phenomenal.
Well, for example, we've got a stock of gold.
Mm-hmm.
And gold is pretty valuable for a few uses. Somewhat in making contact points in computers, in certain chemical processes for dental work, and for jewelry. But for most purposes, it's utterly worthless. So we might as, instead of sitting in a vault in Fort Knox, we could sell it.
Why is it sitting in a vault in Fort Knox? Why is so much of it sitting in a vault?
Part of it's tradition, and part of it's just, the so-called backing for our currency, although we went off the gold standard in the 1970s.
So how does it back us if it were off the gold standard?
just in case anyone asks, we've got this extra money squirreled away.
All right.
But the government also is probably the largest owner of real estate in the United States and in some other parts of the world, too. So that some of that could be sold off.
Why don't they do it?
I don't think they've ever thought of it.
Why not?
I don't know.
Oh.
I'm just saying, when you look at the different possibilities, it may be regarded as a collapse of the government. It may be that some of this property is unsafe. For example, we have an idle gunnery range in the Caribbean in an island near Puerto Rico, where they've used it for naval target practice for so often that it's just unsafe. So I don't think you could sell it to anyone.
But it could help reduce the deficit at least a bit, if one were to consider.
Yes.
Okay.
That's a definite point, and it's something that should be considered, and it would sure help downsize the government. But on the other hand, I doubt that we want to sell our national parks.
No, of course not.
And some other things. We might want to sell offshore drilling rights.
Mm-hmm.
We do that to some degree.
Well, let's go back to your plan and the von Neumann Turnpike.
Okay.
All right. Now, you mentioned that you have, that's one way out of the mess, but what are some of the other ways that you were discussing with me?
If we do nothing, in the sense that just trust the markets and eventually they'll get out of this, we'll be in a depression scenario. Now, just how, if you prefer, since that's a loaded term, perhaps a better term is a strong recession. And nobody knows for sure how long, but I can make a convincing argument that it would take at least 4 years before you'd see an upturn at the earliest. And that would be most unusual. So I think you could argue it comes close to the Great Depression. The second possibility is that you use traditional measures, and you might be able to cut a little time off that. But the Depression scenario, I don't see an upturn for less than 7 to 10 years. And I don't like that, because it's needless. But if the government does intervene with reasonable intelligence and reasonable diligence, it could probably cut that contraction phase down to about 5 or 6 years. I don't think it can do it much shorter by conventional measures. But then the best you can hope for after you start an upturn is to grow a little slower than the historic rates, which are about 3.5%. And part of that is that we're now in a so-called post-industrial society, and the inherent growth rate of such an entity is a bit slower than the classical industrial society that we were used to. So you run that out, and by 2025, we would have a gross domestic product of about $16 trillion a year. And while that's substantially better than our current $13 trillion, it's not anything to brag about. However, if we do a von Neumann Turnpike, we have a chance to get up to about $40 trillion a year by 2025. And the difference between the typical recovery and the von Neumann recovery would be just about enough to write off all of the losses that we've incurred, and that's about $74 trillion.
You've said that $74 trillion represents the greatest loss in history. Could you amplify that?
Well, if you looked at the cost to all parties concerned for World War II and World War I, we didn't spend anywhere near that much money, regardless of whether you were on the winning or losing side. So $74 trillion is a new record. And in fact, just to show that I can put a positive spin on this kind of thing, we could get up and yell and cheer that we've set a new record for a potlatch ceremony. No one in history has ever squandered that much money in so brief a time.
And I asked you when we were talking before to tell me what is a potlatch ceremony, and you talked about the Kwikadel Indians?
Yes, there's a tribe of Indians in the Pacific Northwest called the Kwakiutl.
Oh, Kwakiutl, sorry.
don't ask me for the exact spelling, but from memory, it's Kwaikiutl. And they're a relatively peaceful group that have been around for a long time, and they live in the Pacific Northwest, typically in the state of Washington, Western Canada, and the Alaskan panhandle. But they have a little ceremony called a potlatch, and it was described by an economist named Thorsten Veblen. And basically, if you want status in the Kwakiutl society, you get busy producing material wealth. Well, this may involve things like fishing spears and baskets and clothing and occasionally a canoe for ocean travel, so on. But you make as much of these things as you possibly can. And when you think you've got more than enough, then you challenge your neighbor to a potlatch. And in a public ceremony, you drag out all of your treasures and hope that you have more of them than your rival. And if you do, you win. And in winning, you get to burn all these things.
And why would you want to do that?
Simply to show that your disdain for material wealth. And this is very analogous to war. You simply produce a lot of resources, destroy them, along with people. But of course today, with the possibility of a thermonuclear war, you would not only destroy resources, but all the people in the world, or at least push them back to near the Stone Age. So this is not a viable solution for our problems.
Obviously not, but you were talking to me about the potlatch relative to the need to rethink status and power and what it means in this society. Could you go into that a bit?
Yes, I happen to think that we can produce enough material wealth so that people can live reasonably well. I'm not saying everyone can own mansions and yachts or should, but certainly enough to have an adequate diet, an adequate place to live, adequate health care, adequate schooling, and so on, and even for a much larger population. But money and material wealth, in my view, should not be the primary or only source of social status. There are other possibilities. And what I would suggest is giving people the opportunity to earn additional votes. We get a vote by right of citizenship in our society. And we could add a few other possibilities to direct people's efforts toward more productive areas and activities. And among those points, for example, we could encourage innovation by awarding a vote to someone who comes up with something significantly new by creating real wealth. We could set a threshold. So let's say if you produce it and commercialize an invention that yields at least $1 million a year, you earn an extra vote. If you complete a tour of public service, whether it's military or elected political office or serve in the Peace Corps, you get an extra vote. If
what do you do with your vote?
An advanced degree from an accredited school, not a diploma mill.
But what do you do with your vote? When you get one vote and another vote and another vote, what happens with the vote?
First of all, you can use it in elections. So in a close election, the people who have more votes and have demonstrated that they're productive and committed to the long-term welfare of society now have more influence.
Even though other people are voting for them in a national election, the votes that they receive from those particular wealth-producing or status-producing activities would count more? Would they be
heavier
right. weight?
That's right. For example, if my idiot twin only gets a vote by right of citizenship, I mean, not literally an idiot because they wouldn't be allowed to vote, but let's say my lazy twin, he gets one vote. But based on what I'm recommending, I could have up to seven. So it's
right, so you have seven votes, and now you're in a popular election, but only 100 people vote for you and 3,000 or 10,000 vote for your adversary. What happens to those three votes that, or seven votes that you accumulated?
Well, I can cast them for me. And if enough other people do this, then in a close election, we're on a one-vote basis. Let's say the vote would split out at, to keep life simple, 1,000 versus 1,100. But if 100 people on my side had multiple votes, just 100 of them, it could suddenly turn out to be 1,200 to 1,100.
Well, this is a total restructuring of the society, correct?
It leads toward a restructuring of society on strategic issues, but it does so by informed popular vote. And the basic principles of our democracy are that it would be run by an informed electorate. And right now we have an awful lot of people who have the right to vote who are presumably informed, but obviously are not. And if they worked hard and smart and earned extra votes, they would have more influence.
Well, I like what you're saying, but it does sound a bit idealistic, doesn't it? I mean, not something that one could envision happening perhaps even in the next 20 or 30 years until people finally are simply exhausted by our current system. I mean, after all, even the independent party hasn't gained currency in this country.
Yeah, I agree. But my point is somebody has to get society thinking of other possibilities rather than maintaining exactly what we've done in the past when it demonstrably has not worked too well.
Okay.
So if this can trigger discussion of looking at rewards in a less material way. Now, the British, for example, did it to some extent with the nobility, and that was hereditary. But then they started awarding life peerages for people who did outstanding things, whether it was writing a great bit of music like the Beatles or solving some difficult scientific problem. Excuse me a second. Sorry. I'm just saying we could do much the same thing, and the status would go much more than simply having wealth that you have to flaunt.
I think people might be taken aback to hear what you're saying, and then they would think about it for a few minutes and say, you know, there's something there. There's something worth talking about, because after all, we're all getting tired of watching the rich and the mega-rich flaunt their wealth. Well, maybe not everybody's getting tired of it, not certainly the 1% or 1/10 of a percent that control it, but the rest of the people are a bit tired by it.
Well, I think that there comes a point where exhibitionism has to wear, and it has to be tiring to live that kind of a lifestyle.
With a 12,000-square-foot house where your daughter controls, 14,000 square feet?
I'm not slumming. I'm talking about the 30,000 and 50,000-square-foot house where you have more than one and four and five and six, plus the yacht and the airplane, and you're entitled to it if you've earned it. If you've earned money, you're entitled to spend it pretty much the way you see fit.
But
I'm just saying that a lot of this could be directed toward more beneficial activities than simply squandering stuff.
Right. Now, you are not a rabid fan of free market capitalism, is that correct?
No, that's not quite correct.
Oh, okay.
I, as an economist, am highly enthusiastic about the free market system, and as a consultant, I've made great use of that model. But I am not a fanatic believer that the model accurately describes reality.
Okay.
And therefore, you have to take it with a grain of salt. I happen to know that in this current circumstances, that model is grossly inadequate, in part because it assumes you don't have recessions.
And let's bring it for a moment to Mr. Greenspan.
Well, Mr. Greenspan is an ardent believer in the free market system. At least that's the impression I've gained over the years. But the point in fact is that occasionally the system goes out of whack and you get something like a business cycle downturn. Now, the more recent example of that was the Great Depression, when Keynes pointed out a whole series of flaws in the free enterprise or perfect competition or free market capitalism model, call it what you will. And he did that very deliberately, in part because he felt that since there's so much lip service given to it, no one's going to listen to his recommendations unless he first shows that the model, the standard model of the day, is wrong. And then, of course, the question is, okay, what would you put in its place? And he had some practical suggestions, all of which were ignored. However, what got us out of the Great Depression was World War II. And World War II, in effect, followed the recommendations of Keynes. So in a sense, he was right.
Excuse me.
But he wasn't listened to. And I see a great similarity with the current circumstances. We have a similar problem with similar causes, but we need a better solution than war. And I don't expect to be listened to. I can only hope that someone will say, hey, maybe there's something to this, and we want to check it out.
Well, I asked you not too long ago. I said, if Greenspan is a strong fan of free market capitalism and really wasn't willing to look at the possibility that the markets could fail, how could that be when, in fact, they did fail during the Depression and so on? And your answer was, can you share it with everyone else?
Well, I can give you two arguments.
Okay.
One is the classic economic saying by a guy named Harold Demsetz that believing is seeing. So you only see what you want to believe. You just don't recognize reality or too easily until you get your nose rubbed into it. The second possibility is that countermeasures were put into place after the Great Depression. Reforms, if you will. And I won't go into the technical details. And they worked pretty well for quite a while. But the thing is, the economy kept evolving and changing. And the measures became less and less effective. So right now, those measures essentially have been neutralized, and we're right back in the same type of situation, an economy in a tailspin.
And you're saying basically that Greenspan and others didn't believe it could happen again because those measures had been put in place?
In part because those measures had been put in place, and in part because they wanted to stick to the earlier model of free enterprise or perfect competition, because that model says that it can't happen. Also, that model is much easier to understand. Mathematically, it's a lot easier to handle, and it's a lot easier to explain to Congress.
Well, does Bernanke come open for criticism as well?
I think Bernanke is a bit better informed and realistic, and has studied the Great Depression far more than Dr. Greenspan. But I think he's so busy firefighting, he hasn't run across the ideas that I'm putting forth.
Well, let's come back to your ideas now. Now you're going to put forward this economic revival strategy. strategy. What are the building blocks of your strategy?
Basically two. You've got to get rid of a lot of obstacles, or what in some circles are called sanitary factors. And then you've got to put the turnpike in place. The obstacles can be categorized as both short and long term, and there are a lot of them, but let's take a fast look. That you run into such things as the credit card crunch that's coming, and in fact some people have already hit that. And then you have problems with a second wave of mortgage defaults that'll come in the next year. We've lost about 3 million homes in default this year. The prediction is that we'll lose about 12 million next year.
Whose prediction is that? Again, you don't hear anything about
professional real estate organizations that routinely do these forecasts for banks are now estimating we'll lose about 12 million defaults. I think they're a little optimistic, but it's good enough for planning purposes. Another major possibility that we see an active discussion in the press today is the failure of one or more domestic car makers. And that'll lead to all kinds of problems. The net result of this sort of thing is we're going to see an increase in unemployment, probably close to 16 million by the end of next year. Consumers are seeing tighter credit, which is, of course, cutting their spending, which acts as a depressant to the economy and so on. And then, of course, we have the problems globally, so there's a slackening of international trade. We have an overhang of some $55 trillion in derivatives, or just toxic paper is the popular term for it. And right now, that has a value of zero, so we need to work that out. We're seeing a fall off in revenues for the federal government, states, counties, and cities. And depending on who you talk to, that'll go down by about 25 to 50% over the next few years. So we're going to have very serious government budgetary and prioritization problems, and that's going to cause a lot of disruption. And then we have a whole bunch of long-term problems that are just beginning to come into play, although we've known about them for many years. Settling for mediocrity instead of striving for excellence is one obvious possibility. We've been cutting back on basic research and losing capability there, so that takes a long time to recover, but that is a fundamental element in the long-term growth of an economy. We're seeing climate change and water shortages. Our infrastructure is deteriorating. We have problems with defense and intelligence operations and funding. Our education, or more accurately, our educational system, can certainly be improved by almost any standards, except perhaps a third world countries. We have a host of entitlement issues such as Medicare, Medicaid, so on. And that gets into issues of who's entitled to what and when and how do you fund it. We have a problem with energy dependence or independence. Our environment needs cleaning up. We have health care issues. There are a whole huge, in my opinion, wasteful subsidies that could be eliminated but are politically explosive to deal with. The U.S. is no longer internationally competitive, a term I dislike, but the point is we're accepting it instead of doing something about it. And the net result of a lot of this, of course, is our material standard of living is falling, and people aren't too happy about that. Now, with all these problems, we have a lot to juggle or set priorities on, and our usual methods of handling them just aren't up to that kind of challenge. We have better techniques, but they're ignored or sacrificed by politicians to retain personal power. And that leads us to the last few comments, we have a souring mood and impatience. People want a solution right now to a long-term problem, and that's very difficult to do. We have no plausible recovery plan in place, and I don't think we can get one in place much before the first or possibly second quarter of next year. And even if we get a plan, it takes time to put it into play. There are implementation lags. So you don't see a fast recovery on the horizon, barring a miracle.
And then you're, just to put it in clear in people's minds, that if they should go about the process by doing the same old free market.
They just waste time and resources.
Pardon?
That behavior merely wastes time and other resources, and hence delays a recovery.
Do you have a bad or sinking feeling that that's what they might do?
I'm terrified that it's the most likely possibility. There's a technique in statistics that's commonly used in economics called Bayesian analysis. And in essence, it says when there's more than one possibility and you don't know how likely a possibility each of them is, they're equally likely. I can show you there are three major possibilities: the depression, traditional recovery, and a von Neumann turnpike. Since we don't know how likely any of them are, the Bayesian technique applies. And two chances out of three, we're going to have a miserable time for the next 10 or 20 years.
But that isn't necessary.
That's my point.
Right, that's your point. So I want to come back to your point that the von Neumann turnpike could lead to accelerated growth, incredible growth. You said 10% a year to me.
Well, I'd pick 10% in part because it's just about half the rate we attained in World War II.
Okay.
And I think we can certainly do that even though we're in a post-industrial economy. I think, but I cannot prove to my satisfaction at this point, that we can do substantially better, let's say 15%. But I would not reject the idea that we might be able to do 11 or 12. I just think getting up past 15 is highly unlikely. I won't say it's impossible until we really dig into the problem. But certainly we can do half as well as we did in World War II.
So by digging into the problem, number one, one has to take a different point of view concerning the free market economy. Though it sounds wonderful and we love it, we love the sound, the ring of the bell, it may not be what we need right now. That means we need more government intervention when the country is reeling from the type of intervention we've already suffered?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Yes, we need intervention, and it has to come from the government. But it doesn't have to be more. It just has to be better. It might even be less. A mentor of mine came up with some constructive suggestions along that line back in 1967, and let me run a couple of those ideas past you so that you can have some idea. Here are two, or three or four. He had 12. He felt that we should link top executives' total compensation, not just salary, to that of the President of the United States. Since the President has the most important job, nobody should be compensated more than he or she.
Do you hear hands clapping all over the world for that one? I love it.
Well, the problem there is that some execs are going to say, wait a minute, that's reasonable for administrative activities, but I'm entitled to compensation as an entrepreneur, and that's not fair. You're penalizing entrepreneurship. There's an idea in economics called the least cost rule, which allocates compensation equitably across all functions. And the answer is, if you don't want to be rated like the president or have your compensation linked to that of the president, then just work out the least cost rule and get a fair reward as an entrepreneur, or for your entrepreneurial activities as distinct from your administrative. It's just, it's terribly difficult to apply the least cost rule, but at least it would be fairer and it would encourage, you know, adequate rewards. A second suggestion, these are not in any order of priority, is to limit firms to no more than 5 disparate lines of business. I've consulted to some large companies, and invariably they have trouble allocating resources across their different lines of business. And particularly when those are very different lines. So, for example, take a conglomerate such as the old ITT, which had some 45 different lines of businesses. They were in financial services such as insurance. They were in the hotel business. They were in telecommunications. They were operating the Dew Line and the South Pole base for the Navy. They also ran very large banking operations. As a result of being in so many different businesses, none of them were particularly profitable compared with the best that could be done. And they needed a very large, complex computer model just to keep track of what was going on and show the consequences. So I happen to think if you had smaller firms, I'm not saying minuscule, but smaller and more specialized, they would be more productive. Another suggestion from my mentor was to link corporate taxes to a 5-year moving average of capacity utilization rate, where the capacity rises at the same pace as the fastest growing of either real domestic product or the workforce or the population, so that you penalize inefficient behavior and force firms out of business if they're not efficient, and reward heavily with lower taxes and hence higher profits the more efficient firms.
Well, talk about the automotive industry for a moment. I know that it's a sore spot with you.
Yes, it is. I worked with a colleague on a project for a couple of years trying to see what could be done to save the domestic automobile industry. And the ultimate conclusion was nothing. There's no way to save the old line firms, and that any attempt at rescue is an utter waste.
But yet the government's going to do it.
Well, I think what we'll see is eventually that the government will let these firms go into bankruptcy and try and pick up the use of the workforce and ensure the pensions and so on. But there's no way to keep this terminally ill set of firms alive. It would take infinite resources, and we just don't have those resources. In addition, we have better uses for those resources. So to my mind, it would be criminally wasteful to support them.
And yet, a majority of politicians will support them.
I don't think so.
No?
That's a matter of opinion, but you have to remember, politicians respond to votes, not to money,
mm-hmm.
and not to economic rationality, and that's part of the reason we've gotten into these messes. You know, the politicians voted for ideas that sounded good, got them immediate votes in election or re-election, and then produced the god-awful mess. And you just cannot defy long-term economic laws indefinitely. It's
so
very much like flying an airplane.
Well, do you feel that the public is going to turn against a bailout of the auto industry?
Well, first of all, there are three groups of politicians. There are the politicians who are in favor of this, there are politicians who are opposed, and there are politicians who don't give a damn one way or the other. And the first two groups are relatively small. So some smart person is going to come along and say, look, if you don't care one way or the other, I'll make a deal with you. And politicians love to make deals. And the deal I'll make is this. You agree to vote to protect me now, And if I'm around and I get in a situation where you're in a mess and I don't care one way or the other, I'll vote to protect you. So it's not a matter of just how many votes want to save the auto industry or how many are opposed, but how many of the large block of neutral votes can be swayed. And I don't know, but I think when most of them stop and think, wait a minute, if I vote to save the auto industry, I'm voting to devote resources to help somebody who can't be helped. But that money could be better diverted to help my constituents. And on that basis, I think a lot of these politicians will, in effect, wake up and smell the roses and for once maybe vote sensibly.
Well, we have about, I would say, 4 more minutes now, not quite. And you've stated to me that we have to invest differently. We have to start investing in psychic income.
That's correct.
You said almost every person today, whether they know it or not, owes over $300,000 of that $74 trillion. So what's your final comment on that issue?
Well, essentially, if you take the $74 trillion, which is an estimate, and divide it by the roughly 250 million citizens in the United States, regardless of age, each of us owes about $300,000 to pay off that debt. Obviously, most of us haven't got it. So it's going to fall on a few rich people and a few organizations or society as a whole. But to go back to the other idea of psychic income and a fair or unfair analogy might be, look at the President of the United States and the compensation he or she gets, which is around $500,000 a year, all things considered. And the Pope runs a bigger organization and a more complex one, but doesn't get anywhere near that pay in money terms, but gets a great deal of psychic satisfaction out of prestige, the possibility of sainthood, and so on and so forth. So I'm just saying you can make trade-offs between material wealth and psychic. What's it worth to an economist to, let's say, have a job as a teacher versus having an endowed chair, their status, and even better, maybe winning a Nobel Prize? Yeah, there's $1 million involved, but $1 million doesn't begin to offset the status of being known as a Nobel laureate. There are only about 50 of them running around these days worldwide.
And would that mean, for example, a dismantling of our love affair with idols, literally idols, and the music or pop industry or other industries that don't really contribute to the development of society but have that ultimate glow?
They all contribute.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think the emphasis on sheer materialism and nothing else. We had a recent incident in history with junk bonds where there was massive fraud. And some of these people were idolized for the sheer amount of money they stole. I don't think that's quite sensible. I don't think we want to make heroes out of bad examples. But it's kind of tough to award status to good examples. We have a lot more good examples that are not highly recognized. Parents who behave themselves and raise a decent family. People who fulfill their political offices with reasonable integrity and competence. Members of boards of directors of condos and home associations who are considerate and polite and diligent. These people deserve some recognition and some rewards. It isn't just the satisfaction of a job well done.
Well, David, now as we're coming to the final minute, I want to end this program by quoting you.
Okay,
I'm going to quote something you said to me earlier today, and you said we have to grow up mentally and emotionally and demand that the government act in the strategic long-term interest not only of the country, but of the globe. And you said that the current situation is rare, but it's not unfamiliar, it's not hopeless, it takes a different and sustained treatments. We got into this mess, you said, because of quick fixes and total disregard for long-term consequences. You also said if anyone in the leadership capacity blocks a more positive and practical approach, we will be in an awful mess. But I think that you're more hopeful than not. And it's been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well,
Dynamic Dave. And I want to thank you and welcome you back again in the future, I hope, yes?
Thank you.
Okay.
I look forward to working with you in the future.
Well, we're working together every day. We have to tell people that because you're one of my favorite people on the planet, I must say. So this is Dr. Joyce Starr with RightsRadio.com and StarPublications.com, and we look forward to seeing you in two more weeks. Bye-bye.